you.
Some of you will know that I work for a local health insurance provider, not the one that's gone. My role requires me to wear many hats, but the one which weighs the heaviest is that which is worn as a compliance officer. Now, a compliance officer, not always welcomed with open arms. Too often I hear us unfairly labelled sales prevention officer, whereas in fact we do genuinely want the firm to succeed and grow, just not at the expense of complaints and lawsuits. Regulations have a purpose, to protect the firm, protect the customer. And because firms cannot be trusted to control themselves, a regulator steps in, lays down the law, backed by penalties for non-compliance. The compliance officer takes the rules of the regulator, understands them, and turns them into something the firm can use, and then keep a close eye on what happens afterwards. This can be easier said than done. Good firms understand the importance of the rules and accept they are there for good reason. They just get on with it. Some firms quite huff and puff, and roll the eyes, but accept that they are needed, and good sense usually wins through. Others, sadly, need a little more persuasion before they realise the compliance officer was right all along. In some ways, a compliance officer is a modern day minor prophet. Now, before you all stone me for heresy, think about this. A compliance officer receives the words of the regulator and passes them on to the people. Some people go, yes, let's do this. Whereas others stick their head in the sand, their fingers in their ears, and carry on regardless until the regulator says, through the compliance officer, too late, your time's up. All I know is the more I read into Amos's life and his prophetic work, the more I felt his pain. So, let's start with some background. The year is about 750 BC, and unusually for this region, there is peace. In fact, a whole generation has grown up in peace. External threats from the likes of Assyria have receded, and the internal conflict between Israel in the north and Judah in the south has ended. And they've learned to live in what we might call a peaceful coexistence. So they did not need to make war. Instead, they made money. King Jeroboam II is on the throne. He opens up trade routes with Egypt and Asia, and the economy booms. Luxury goods, status symbols, second homes. Israel was a consumer-driven society. They wanted stuff, and lots of it. This led to a new aristocracy, a hugely wealthy upper class. At the same time, the middle class shrank, and the poorer classes were squeezed out altogether. And amid all of this, we have rampant corruption. Money talked, and cash was their god. They were even trading on the Sabbath. This inevitably seeped into the legal world, and judges could be bought and sold. And the poor could not get justice, let alone somewhere to live and food to eat. And religion was booming, but not the good one. Yahweh-centered worship was being mixed with pagan beliefs imported from the surrounding nations, with a great focus on the worship of false gods and fertility idols. The worship of money and sex by a people who were supposed to be in a close covenant relationship with Yahweh became the norm, and no one seemed to notice. So Yahweh had a problem. He had chosen Israel to be his holy people, through whom the whole world would come to know him. This was his great plan, and it was going wrong. And it's into this environment Amos arrives. So what do we know about Amos? He's not a professional prophet. He is a shepherd and a farmer, and a poor one at that. As it says in Amos 7, verse 14, Amos answered, "I was neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet, but I was a shepherd, and I also took care of sycamore fig trees." He comes from a place called Tekoa, 12 miles south of Jerusalem in Judah. He is a foreigner. He is called to cross the border into the northern territory of Israel. Notice, there is no one in Israel God was able to call. The priests are all corrupt, and they are no longer preaching the word of Yahweh. They care more about money than they do about holiness. And Amos follows his calling. He stands alone on the temple steps and he preaches. And boy, does he preach with both barrels. And so the book of Amos is this collection of sermons spoken over many years, gathered as a permanent reminder to God's people. There's lots of pictures, visions, and poetry. But this is not light-hearted, cheerful prose setting out God's thoughts. It's a heavy, passionate dirge. And we get clear insight into what makes God sad, angry, and sick. So, there is a lot going on in Amos, and we're only just going to scratch the surface here this morning in the time that we have. There are lots of Amos-related sermons on YouTube, if you care to have a look. Some of them are less than an hour. But as I went through it, I did think there were three clear messages coming out, and these are what I'm going to sort of think about this morning. So, the first one is, with great blessing comes great responsibility. Amos opens with a very clever and yet devastating message. He starts by bringing God's judgment not on Israel, but on the countries which surround Israel. Its neighbours, Damascus, Gaza, Tyre, followed by its cousins, Edom, Ammon, and Moab, all of whom have shared ancestry, followed by its sister, Judah, which has rejected God. And anyone who is listening to Amos at this point will be, they'll be all over this. Amen. Preach it, brother. This will be good stuff. And the audience will be in the palm of Amos' hand. But then come the first big broadside. In chapter 2, verse 6, the people of Israel have sinned again and again, and I will not let them go unpunished. The accusations are set out. They have sold people into slavery, ignored the poor, and desecrated the temples. Why is this a problem? Well, the second big broadside follows swiftly afterwards in chapter 3, verse 2. You only have I chosen of all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for your sins. Yahweh knows what everybody else is up to, but they are not his people. He has chosen Israel, and he has established a special relationship, a covenant relationship. It is through these people that Yahweh intends to make himself known to the world. There is a great calling from the people of Israel, and with this great calling comes this great responsibility. The Israelites are probably on board with Amos up to this point, and they probably expect him to say, "You only have I known, therefore I will bless you and protect you." He doesn't. He says, "Therefore I will punish you." Amos' words are meant to shake. This is meant to pull the people up short. It is shock and awe tactics of the highest order, and it is supposed to hurt. At the heart of Amos' message is a truth that Israel had completely misunderstood. Their prosperity was not proof of God's approval, it was proof of God's trust. Because Israel was chosen, because they were blessed, and because they stand in this unique covenant relationship with Yahweh, they were held to a higher standard, not another one. Yahweh set those standards and trusted him to keep those standards by obeying his commandments and worshipping him as their God. No one else. And whilst Israel proved worthy of this trust, they were blessed. The problem was Israel took the blessing and shunned their responsibility. Israel wasn't chosen so they could live better lives than everybody else. They were chosen so through their works, actions and lives, the world would see what Yahweh was like and want to know him too. Which meant very practical and, for this time, unusual behaviours. Justice in the courts, honesty in business, care for the poor, faithfulness in worship. Israel was never meant to be the end point for Yahweh's blessing. It was meant to be the place through which blessing flowed out to others. But instead, blessing turned into entitlement, and the prosperity was seen as proof that everything was fine. Economy booming, tick. Borders secure, tick. Religion busy, double tick. They assumed Allah was pleased with them, but Amos stands up and says, no. All this blessing does not mean I am impressed with you. It means I am watching you. And the more you are given, the more I expect of you. And the sad thing is this, Israel wasn't denying Yahweh. They simply stopped letting him shape how they lived. He was no longer the most important prince in their lives. And their relationship with stuff was blocking their relationship with Yahweh. And when that happens, it interferes with your relationship with others. This is why Amos is so unsettling. He's not preaching to a nation in crisis, but to the one at the height of success, but where its success has become its greatest weakness and danger. And as Amos spells out later, the problem is not that Israel has too much blessing, it's that they've forgotten where the blessing has come from. And when you forget the source of your blessing, it doesn't just change how you live, it changes how you worship. So, Amos turns up the heat. And with great blessing comes the call to greater worship. Amos has spoken with great fervour about injustice, complacency, and moral drift. And now he turns attention to Israel's worship. And what Yahweh says here are some of the strongest words he ever speaks to his people. Chapter 5, verse 21, I hate, I despise your religious festivals. Your assemblies are a stench to me. Even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not. Remember, Yahweh is not speaking to pagans. He is speaking to his own people, the ones he has chosen to carry his name into the world. Israel hadn't stopped worshipping. They hadn't abandoned the festivals. They were still meeting, still singing, still sacrificing. But worship had become a performance for one another and not a time of thanksgiving to Yahweh, the one who had rescued their ancestors from slavery and blessed them as a nation. They honoured Yahweh with their lips, but not their lives. So Yahweh goes even further. Away with the noise of your songs, I will not listen to the music of your hearts. It's a devastating line. He's not expressing a musical preference. He is dismissing their worship as nothing more than noise. And ongoing the noise-cancelling headphones. Worship which fails to acknowledge God's rightful place in your life is more than just pointless, it is offensive. God is not looking for enthusiasm and effort, for the right words and the right rituals. He is looking for obedient lives that reflect his purposes. And it's a challenge for today's church, as much as it was a failing of Israel. Churches which value outward physical expressions of worship more than they do for heartfelt internal dialogue of thanksgiving and praise between the person and God. Churches which worship the singing of the multi-piece band, which provides the music more than they do the one to whom they are supposed to be singing. I've experienced both, and it's not good. Not here, I would hasten to add. Good worship lifts, sorry, good music lifts worship, but it should never replace the one we worship. Instead, Yahweh tells us what true worship looks like in verse 24. Let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. Yahweh doesn't want worship full of rituals, polished songs, and clever sermons if the rest of our lives are trouble. If worship is real, obedience flows from it naturally and in an unending stream. This is the ultimate consequence of forgetting Yahweh. Religious acts continue, but the covenant relationship is broken, and he cannot let this stand. So Amos speaks the unthinkable. Exile. The people to be removed from the land they assumed was secure. A nation ended. And in chapters 7 and 8 we get visions. Locusts, fire, ripe fruit ready to spoil, and a sanctuary destined for destruction. And about 40 years later, it happens. Israel is conquered, and the northern kingdom ceases to exist. The population is deported and dispersed. Shouldn't surprise anyone that when you go through Amos, you say, yeah, this is the same today. Even stuff like this desire for second houses and holiday homes and that kind of stuff, where there are a whole bunch of people who still can't get houses of their own. Lack of justice for certain areas of the population. People say the Bible is relevant today. Let's wrap this up. We've talked about great blessing. And we now will talk about great blessing comes great hope. Israel, Yahweh's people, faced judgment and destruction. In chapter 9, verse 8, we read, surely the eyes of the sovereign Lord are on the sinful kingdom. I will destroy it from the face of the earth. But then comes that little bit of light in the darkness. Yet I will not totally destroy the descendants of Jacob, declares the Lord. For I will give the command, and I will shake the people of Israel among the nations, as grain shaken in a sieve, and not a pebble will reach the ground. It is a promise of redemption, recovery, and restoration. It is a promise of hope. Since then, the people of God have always faced hardship and persecution. In more recent times, the church has faced threats from the likes of Mao Zedong in China, North Korea, and Iran, where it has been government policy to suppress and ban the Christian faith. And yet, the Christian church survives. And not just survives, but it flourishes. People are always predicting the end of Christianity, sometimes through violence, sometimes through ideology, new atheists, for example, and sometimes just simply through neglect and a lack of pastoral care. But the people of God, the remnant, we're still here. Today, the church is vast and global. It's about 40% of the world's population spread across the world, expressing their love for God in countless cultures and languages. The church has come through centuries of sifting. Kingdoms have risen and fallen. Ideologies have come and gone. Battles have been won and lost. But what remains is not a church propped up by powerful people, but a weak and a needy people held by God. The remnant continues to endure because God holds it safe in his loving hands. We do lament the closure of church buildings, and I get that. But Amos reminds us that God's people are sifted and not discarded. Practices change, fabric decays, structures fall away, yet the church itself does not disappear. New worshipping communities are planted, attendance in many places is growing, and the Christian faith continues in different shapes. Go and see what Ocean Church is doing in Hanworthy. Because what we are seeing is not the end of the church, but the sifting of it. The church of God is far from dead, and it's a long way from even being on life support. It is alive and well. Amos does speak to us with a sharp message. God cares deeply about justice, holiness and faithfulness, and he will judge those who do not live out his passions. And it is a message that is supposed to unsettle us because it asks difficult questions of our lives, of our churches, and of our world. But it is not a message of despair. God does not abandon his people. Going to the right, Amos was a tough read. It had hard words, and yet ultimately it is a message of hope. Whatever sifting we go through, of one thing we can be certain, God holds his church. It is safe in his hands, and this is our sure, unshakable hope built on him.